Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello and welcome to Signs of Life Radio, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. Our guest tonight is Dr. Christopher Kerr, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. We would also like to welcome back HugsFromHeaven.com as a renewal business member for 2016. So, Bob, what's running around in your mind today?
Well, we have a surprise guest in our studio here tonight, Siri Bernson, who is a certified medium with Forever Family Foundation, is doing an event for the foundation tomorrow, and she's visiting today. And she said that she's going to want to see what the radio show was like. And I told her, well, why not? We should ask her a few questions since we have her here, right? So, you know, one of the things that we're going to be talking about with our terrific guest that we're going to have on with in a little while, Dr. Kerr, is about hospice and deathbed visions and different types of end-of-life experiences. So it made me think... to ask you this question, Siri, as a medium, a lot of people think that, well, I've even heard people say to me, well, I wish I was a medium because then I wouldn't grieve, you know. Like, you know, so do mediums grieve?
We do because we are human. So it's a part of the whole passage of life. We all grieve.
And certainly you know that you talk to the dead, so you know that your loved one still survives, but yet...
Yeah, but it's the fact that I think I've thought about this quite a bit. It's the fact that, you know, you have your loved one here in a physical form, and then one day they're gone. And we always long to see them and feel them and feel they're hugging us again, and we don't have that. And that's a huge part of life, is that the tenderness of touch that we have... we no longer have. So, yes, of course we grieve.
Right, and that's why no matter how many personal experience one has, I mean, it still doesn't take away, you know, the pain of not having them in the physical. But it certainly makes your life a lot easier to lead, knowing that they survive in some form rather than get annihilated into the dust.
Well, you know, I mean, you can look at the two spectrums, because I've gone from one spectrum being the atheist and to the absolute opposite spectrum, where when I was an atheist, it was a very simple way of living. You believe in nothing. You believe that you're born and then you die, you go into the ground, and that's it.
Right.
You don't even worry about anything else.
Right.
And so being a medium is the complete opposite, is that now you know that there's an afterlife, so there's a tremendous amount of solace that comes with it, and a tremendous amount of peace that comes with it. And, of course, I wish that everyone was a medium. Mediums, though, are very, very sensitive people, and I would not wish it on anyone to walk around every single day being that sensitive. But when a person does, though, sit with a medium and they do receive this comfort of the afterlife, I think that slowly but surely, you know, they can have one session with one medium and they can have another one with another medium. But slowly but surely, the grief sort of transforms and it diminishes and it sort of shifts into a different energy. And then when we, as people, we get to realize that we can talk to them ourselves. And when we also learn to look for the signs, I think that's when the healing begins to take place also.
Mm. And a lot of people will... say in no uncertain terms that they think, you know, mediumship is the strongest form of evidence that we survive, you know, physical death, and you know, at the foundation, we're always talking about different types of evidence, other types of evidence of other people survived. Have you given any thought to that? Mediumship aside, you can't answer because you're a medium, but forgetting about that, I mean, is there anything that you find compelling? I mean, when you consider, I mean, whether it be near-death experiences or deathbed visions or dream visits or, you know, what?
I think I would say for sort of the most people is looking for the signs that happen through electronics, like the TV, the phone, the radio. The song comes on, and you were just thinking about that person, or the lights begin to flicker, like I just saw your video of the lights flickering. I mean, those are signs. So this to me is evidence. And I think especially when I can, as a medium, when I can look on this specific piece of evidence that has, if there's a person in the spirit world that is talking about a very specific piece of thing that is either flickering or the phone call or the something, and the recipients, if there's a phone session, you know, the recipient, they can say, yes, I know what that is. I think that in itself is evidence, because I was not in the room when the lights were flickering on the phone or this or that was shifting or changing, but I can narrate it from the perspective of the spirit. Mm. That, to me, is evidence. When you have a completely neutral person being able to describe the situation, I think that is evidence.
Yeah, and we know that there's a vast numbers of people dismiss such things because it doesn't fit into their framework of understanding. I mean, if you don't believe in life after death and you see light flickering, it's just the light flickering. But, you know, knowing what you know and knowing what we know, yeah, sometimes it is just a light flickering, but sometimes it's not. You know? So
sometimes it's not. I think that when you get a voicemail that was not there before, or you get a phone call from someone who's been passed for a while. I mean, I can give you one thing that my dad passed away a couple of years ago. And just this week, there was a medium that brought through a message, and he was acknowledging my need. So we're talking about 3,000 miles away, different part of the world. He comes through a medium here in the United States, and he has a very specific message for his granddaughter. I saw you getting your documentation, or I saw you getting your documents. She just did her confirmation. And I believe it was the same day, my sister back home in Iceland, she got messages from her dad. It was some sort of an email that came up, and he's been deceased now for a few years. And she got an email from him.
This was about at the same time?
Really about the same time.
Yeah.
And she didn't understand. And so my sister and my mom are a little bit naive in these things, and I have to educate them. And so when I told my sister, oh, dad came through with a message, my sister, well, that's odd. I got this email from dad a couple of days ago, and I said, well, that's a sign. And she's like, what do you mean? And I said, yeah, that's a sign. And so I'm even having to educate my own family about these things.
I would imagine so.
Yeah.
You know, and we do hear those things a lot. It seems like sometimes when a discarnate wants to get a message through, it's as if they... you know, they hedge their bet. They try to get through to many different people, see who's receptive, and they know they're going to get through to one of them at least, sometimes more than one. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be talking a lot more about this stuff with our guest tonight. And when we come back from the break, we're going to have Dr. Christopher Kerr, and we're going to be talking about some fascinating things that he's research he's conducted in the hospice setting. So stay with us, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
Does consciousness survive death? Can technology be used to interact with the deceased? Can hearing from the dead heal the living? At the Windbridge Institute, we are working to answer these and similar questions. Through our studies with certified research mediums, we are examining psychic abilities and communication with the other side, offering insights into the limitless nature of consciousness, and unlocking the possibilities of our bodies, minds, and spirits. Be a part of it. Become a Windbridge member today. Please visit www.windbridge.org to learn more. The CAMLAC Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the CAMLAC Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.kamlak.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
Imagine seeing spirits are spontaneously speaking indigenous Brazilian rainforest languages. Janet Mayer, a psychic medium, does just that. In her new book, Spirits, They Are Present, she opens the door to her private life in order to share her compelling, fearful, and at times humorous journey, providing evidence that when we die, we simply make a transition to another life. Spirits, They Are Present, available now at www.janetmayer.net, Amazon, and other online booksellers. Order your copy today.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. After-death communication is an accepted occurrence in many cultures throughout the world. But for many others, proof of this phenomenon is essential. And research shows that contact helps move people through loss and grief. The Sign Registry allows people to register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to specific loved ones. Contact the Forever Family Foundation at foreverfamilyfoundation.org or go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Christopher Kerr. Our sponsor is the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. Bob?
And Dr. Christopher Kerr is the Chief Medical Officer at the Center for Hospice and Palliative Care in Buffalo, where he's worked since 1999. His background in research has evolved from bench science towards the human experience of illnesses witnessed from the bedside, specifically patients' dreams and visions at the end of life. Although medically ignored, these near-universal experiences often provide comfort and meaning, as well as insight into the life led and the death anticipated. Welcome, Dr. Kerr. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I mean, a good place to start would be with your background. I'm always curious, somebody that's doing this type of research. I mean, when you were younger, did you often contemplate what happens after you die? Or, I mean, did you consider yourself to be spiritual in nature?
No, I wish I could claim I was. I certainly think I had the questions that everybody has, what happens afterwards, and certainly not religious, but formally, but certainly to some degree spiritually inclined.
And how does your medical career take you to hospice?
Completely by accident. I was actually a cardiology fellow, and I needed to moonlight to support my family. And I just saw Ned asking for somebody to come and see patients in the home. And I really didn't know what was involved. And I was very fond of hospitals, acute medicine. And, you know, I got into it. And, you know, a few months later, I'm thinking, you know, I'm really happy and fulfilled. And I think the work is very meaningful. And so I made a change. Not planned, just kind of fell into it, and that was 16 years ago, and I've never looked back.
Mm. And, you know, a good percentage of our audience is familiar with end-of-life experiences, you know, the term deathbed visions. For those who aren't, I mean, can you just give a brief description of what you would consider to be an end-of-life experience?
Yeah, I think every dying person, you know, we tend to think of dying in the physical dimensions, mostly of organ systems and of decline. But then there's this whole other experience that's subjective, that's unseen, and it's only seen from the person who's actually going through it. And those subjective experiences of dying are the end of life experiences, particularly dreams and visions. It's just a near universality that people who are dying are often flooded with intense dreaming visions that are essentially virtual. And that's really, I guess, how I would define it.
Mm. And people that have visions, sometimes it's in a waking state, and sometimes they're in a dream state. Correct?
Yeah, and I think it's a good question. And you know, I think the definitions are critical, but I'm not sure as we know the answer. There's certainly a school of thought that feels that it's lucid dreaming. And in our study, 50% of the people reported that it was happening when they were both asleep and awake. So some may be, you know, clearly visions, and others may be lucid dreamings, which gives a sensation that they're awake, or at least aware of the experience, looking at it.
Yeah, and the common objections that you hear are that, you know, when somebody sees a vision of a deceased loved one, that it's hallucination or some form of dementia or some medically induced event, but in fact, yeah, any of these take place while the person is clear thinking and lucid, do they not?
Yeah, that was really the part of the reason why we did the research, was just that it's easy to dismiss these experiences medically as drug-induced, failing mind, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, what we were finding was quite the opposite. They were acutely aware. In fact, they had heightened awareness. They were cognitively organized, not disorganized. They could sort out their surroundings. And it was really, really important to validate that experience. And that's one of the reasons why we film so many of our patients, is because it's really, I think that people have a perception that's a misperception, and I think until you have to see it to believe it. So if you know, if you look at our YouTube channel, there's quite a few patient videos, and they're as cognitively intact as you and I. What makes it confusing is that most people in the dying process certainly have periods of altered lucidity.
Right.
And so delirium is a common process. But delirium is very different in that delirium doesn't have organized themes. And it's certainly not, you know, rich in detail. It's things like, you know, spiders are on me, or there's snakes coming down from the ceiling. It tends to cause fear. And that's probably the biggest distinction, is delirium causes agitation. End-of-life experiences provide comfort and insight and meaning and reunion and grace, all of these others. So the impact of experiences couldn't be more polar opposite. You know, delirious patients are often tied up and medicated, and aren't coherent. Their thoughts are all over the place and rambling and tangential, where people who have end-of-life experiences are very organized in their thinking.
Yeah, and it's really illustrated with the near-death experience when you have somebody who's thinking, and then maybe they don't even have brain waves, and you would expect them to have distorted hallucinatory type of experiences, and they exhibit clear thinking at a time when that should be impossible. So I guess it's the same kind of situation with a deathbed vision or an end-of-life experience, and clear lucid thinking when you wouldn't expect it.
Yeah, I mean, it's an absolute paradox. Yeah. And, we followed things like medications and whatnot. In fact, in our second study, every time somebody had an experience, we also screened them for delirium. And, we didn't do that really for our own amusement. It's just to address the criticism that it's easy to dismiss these people as confused. So we use, there's screening tools for confusional states. Mm. And we proved that they weren't confused. And I mean, you really just have to see the videos, and these aren't confused people.
Right. Now you have a YouTube channel that people can go to?
Yes. Yep.
How do they gain access to that?
I'm going to look it up as while we're talking here, because I actually don't know. I know it's on YouTube, and it's probably Hospice Buffalo.
Okay. Or if they put in your name, Christopher Kerr, K-E-R-R, it'll come up to it too. And also see your TED Talk, which I would highly recommend.
If you see the TED Talk, which is on YouTube, there might be a link there. But
right. I always found it perplexing that I remember one time I wrote an article about deathbed visions, and I called it a dirty little secret. It's perplexing how near-death experiences are today commonly discussed and written about, but for some reason, deathbed visions, for the most part, remain hidden today. I mean, why do you think that is?
Oh, I think it's a few reasons. It's really interesting. It's true. The truism is that through the lens of medicine, they have no value, because medicine is comparable with the brain and not the mind, the objective and not the subjective, things you can measure and see objectively and quantify, and all of these things couldn't be farther from that. So it's easier to look at an x-ray of a broken bone than it is to understand what somebody's experience is, for that matter, how their mood is. So I think there's a strong bias against things that are experienced rather than can actually be quantified. I think that's part of it. And I think medicine is in an unhappy place when it doesn't have all its answers. And this is one of these things where you just have to accept. I think what's interesting is that you could have a patient seen by 10 doctors. None of them would understand this or go there necessarily. Yet the patient's family, particularly if they've lived long enough, it seems as though the non-medical components of our society have better awareness of this. It's so often the case that I'll have residents who have no idea what I'm talking about, yet the patient's family do because they've seen it in another family member or in a friend who is dying.
Right, but unfortunately, sometimes these family members who witness these things still don't talk about it publicly for fear of being, judged or labeled
Well, it's actually funny you say it. There's actually a study that was done. It's done out of Ireland. It was where they asked people who worked with patients, how the frequency in which they experience this and how often they acknowledge it, and they acknowledge that they underreported it for fear of ridicule.
Yeah, I could imagine.
I think that's really one of the values of our research, and I think of what we're trying to do is at least give it permission to occur openly, provide some normalcy for it.
Yeah, I mean, like I think you mentioned, I mean, one of your goals is to demystify these experiences and bring them into the mainstream. And I applaud you for that because I know it's somewhat of an uphill battle. I mean, do you still get criticism among your medical colleagues, or do they kind of?
You know, they're pretty. It's pretty easy to shut them up when you show them a video of somebody, you know,
right.
a child describing these experiences. You know, you can't dismiss. I try to have the patients be their own messengers rather than myself. And it's it's powerful.
Yeah, it really is. And I was so happy, you know, to come across your, you know, hospice. I know, frankly, a number of years ago, we at the Forever Family Foundation tried to make some inroads certain hospice settings. We run these what we term afterlife discussion groups, which are these small, safe groups that we all hold across the United States. And we always thought, what better place for a such a group than in hospice, where people, you know, have substantial fear about where they're going and what in the process of dying, and a lot of the hospices that we had contacted, you know, immediately shut us down, and you know, sort of we don't, you know, talk about such things. And yet, you know, there are progressive, forward-thinking hospices, evidently the one that you helped direct, that are open to it. So why is there still such a reluctance in the hospice world to life after death?
I think a hospice tries to remain in a very neutral spot when it comes to issues of spirituality. I imagine at some level they're concerned about being open to ridicule as well. But you know, you're absolutely correct. If you think about it, it's one of the chief tenets of hospice is to normalize the dying process in a way that's healthy. I mean, and ultimately the shame here is that these experiences are so therapeutic, not just for the individual, but also for the family. And so it's really a lost therapeutic moment. I mean, the one thing we find in our work and our studies is that, you know, inevitably, so often, the experiences the patient have are specific to that individual's need, whether it's a need to be forgiven or reconciled with or reunited. And so they're inherently have value. And so to deny them is to deny something that has great worth.
From a research perspective, you don't get into this so much, but the implications of having, you know, these visions near death, really extraordinary, because the implication is that we have assistance when our time comes to cross over to hell. And that is powerful.
Well, and, you know, there are cultures and indigenous people throughout history who have valued them for that reason, that it was a way to tie to our ancestors and a way to provide guidance. You know, the guiding theme is actually one of the more common ones. You know, there's nothing new here. It's been talked about throughout the world, throughout time.
Mm.
Just not much from medicine, and that's one of the reasons why we thought it was important, or I always personally felt it was important. It's unfortunate, but in a way, it kind of had to come from the medical side of the fence in part, for it to at least have a different level of legitimacy. So that's why we've published quite a bit on this, and every time we study it, we study with a lot of rigor, you know, to make sure that we're doing it correctly by screen for confusion or monitoring medications and videotaping and all that stuff, just so that it holds up to scrutiny.
You have to. You have to. in the type of work that you're doing. I mean, is it true most people that work in hospice and critical care, they it's sort of like a barometer. They know when physical death is near, when their patients start talking to people that they can't see. Is that sort of a guidepost that people use?
Yeah, that's actually what got me into this, was I couldn't believe that my colleagues in nursing and spiritual care, music therapy, they all had could prognosticate better than I could. And, you know, I talked about it in my TED Talk. There were just experiences where they'd say, oh, no, that person's dying. And I thought, no, we can do more to, you know, give them more time. And they said, oh, no, they're dying. They're seeing their mother. And I thought, what the hell are they talking about? And so that's why we did the study. We would speak to people every day up until the time of their death to see if what they were dreaming of changed. And sure enough, as they approach death, the frequency of intense dreaming goes up dramatically. But also what they see changes. They start to see predominantly the deceased. And it's interesting because seeing the deceased was associated with the greatest level of comfort. So there's this built-in mechanism that as you're approaching death, you're flooded with dreams and visions of deceased people, and they quite naturally provide you with comfort and lessen the fear of dying.
So I guess, you know, the term, which is probably why you prefer the end-of-life experiences, which is a broader term, but when we use deathbed visions, a lot of people have the misconception that that means that it's at the moment of death, but yet these visions can occur, weeks and months before physical death, correct?
Yeah, and that was really deliberate on our part because, throughout time, when they talk about deathbed visions, they tend to think there's a bias to think about them as apparitions that are, you know, sudden singular events that, you know, herald death immediately. And whereas, you know, our first study, we were looking at people several weeks before death, and we found out that most of them, when we came into the study, were already dreaming. So we had to go farther back. So, yeah, they can often go back months before dying. And, the typical story is, you know, I'm not somebody who normally remembers my dreams, but, you know, now I'm having these intense, really virtual experiences.
Right. So when you observe families, you know, sitting with their loved one in hospice, and the patient has, you know, a vision, what's the reaction of the family? I know it must vary, but what's the general reaction of the people at the bedside? Do they?
It often depends on their age.
Yeah.
Because again, it seems to be the case that if you've lived to 90, more than likely you've seen somebody have one of these things. And there seems to be, you know, haven't studied this, but there seems to be just this is natural, and this makes sense. You know, it's much harder for a 30-year-old to understand that. A lot of times there's just enormous relief. You know, and the best examples are when there's a couple that's been married for 50, 60 years, and they shared the loss of a child. And the spouse is looking down at the bed and at his life partner, and she's holding their lost child. I mean, it's profound. There are certainly people who it creates an obstacle to the bedside, and that's really one of our roles, is to say, you know, this is normal, and it's healthy, and it can be wonderful, and you should inquire. And it's amazing how people, once they break down that veil, they'll get close to it, and they're intrigued. They often learn things. You know, I had somebody recently whose mother reverted to her Polish language, and the daughter's sitting with her hands on her lap in the corner, and, you know, when she's encouraged to kind of engage, you know, next day she's sitting there and she's taking notes, and she's learning about things about her mother and her childhood in Poland that she didn't know. So it tends to be one of these things that can bring people closer if it's contextualized, you know, for them.
Yeah, I remember when my mother-in-law was passing. Of course, we're kind of immersed in this subject, so we knew we were doing that same thing. She was speaking with her mother, who of course was deceased for many years. So we brought out the notebook and started taking notes. Unfortunately for us, she was speaking in Hungarian, which we don't speak.
Right. Yeah, I've seen a lot of that.
Yeah. I still have a workbook that someday I have to get translated. So.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to go to a break. We have lots more to talk about, and so stay with us. I'll be back in a few minutes with Dr. Christopher Kerr.
Does consciousness survive death? Can technology be used to interact with the deceased? Can hearing from the dead heal the living? At the Windbridge Institute, we are working to answer these and similar questions. Through our studies with certified research mediums, we are examining psychic abilities and communication with the other side, offering insights into the limitless nature of consciousness and unlocking the possibilities of our bodies, minds, and spirits. Be a part of it. Become a Windbridge member today. Please visit www.windbridge.org to learn more.
Hello, my name is Piero Calvi Parisetti, MD. I invite you to discover my video course on Evidence for Life After Life, a professional counseling resource for the bereaved and the dying.
Transform the fear of death. Heal the pain of a loss by learning about life after life.
For more information and a free preview, visit www.drparisetti.com. That's drparisetti in one word, .com.
Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed Gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you could find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
If you're just tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Christopher Kerr, Our sponsor is the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. We'd like to encourage you to sign up for our next webinar, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. It will be on Wednesday, May 4th from 9 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time with New York Times bestselling author Leslie Kane. All the details are on our events page on the Forever Family Foundation website. That's foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Please follow the directions to reserve your seats. Once you register and pay, you'll receive an email requesting you to confirm your registration. Watch for additional webinars as posted on the Forever Family Foundation events page. As of this morning, only 101 people have entered our annual Holiday of the Earth raffle. You do the math. Five people will win one hour medium readings with our Forever Family Foundation certified mediums, Amy Utzman, Renee Buck, Dave Campbell, Lynn LeClaire, or Bobby Allison. The drawing is next week on Earth Day, April 22nd. You really need to enter if you appreciate odds of winning like this. And don't miss our annual grief retreat. This is your weekend about you and healing and connecting with your loved ones in spirit. We begin on Friday evening at 4:30 p.m. on July 22nd and end at 5:30 p.m. on Sunday, July 24th. It's easy to get to by plane, train, or automobile, and past attendees will tell you it is worth the trip from anywhere. 33 of our only 50 seats are already taken, and we have one room left on premises. But be certain before you sign up, keeping in mind the necessity of our no-refund policy. Check the events page on our website regularly for newly added events, webinars, visionary explorers, and afterlife discussion groups. Just to let our listeners know what they might be missing that's coming up free, we have our very first afterlife discussion group in Minnesota. We'll meet on May 7th. Visionary Explorers Group meets online Saturday, May 14th. And Cold Spring Harbor, New York Afterlife Discussion Group meets on May 25th. And please, please, please help us keep all of our programs going by visiting our website and clicking on the donation button. It's on every single page. Because of the work we do not receive the grants and funding that other traditional not-for-profits enjoy. And you can also help us pay our bills by participating in iGive.com, Amazon.com, or Amazon Smile, great not-profits, and WellZoo. Just make certain that you have designated Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice in each of these donation opportunities. You do the shopping, they make the donations to us. Visit foreverfamilyfoundation.org for all event links, information, and registration. And if you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us via email at businessmembership@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. Back to you, Bob.
And we're back with Dr. Christopher Kerr. He's the chief medical officer at the Center for Hospice and Palliative Care. Some people had called in and wanted to know, again, how to reach Dr. Kerr, find out more information. If you just Google Dr. Christopher Kerr, K-E-R-R, Hospice Buffalo, you'll see a YouTube link for a TED Talk that he gave, which is a wonderful talk. And on that same YouTube page, you'll see links to other YouTubes and get a lot more information that way.
I have the site now.
Okay.
So if you want to see patient videos, you could just type in Hospice Buffalo.
Okay.
And on that main page, you'll see a heading that says Palliative Care Institute. And if you press that on, you'll see a series. If you want to see the TED Talk, you just write my name, Chris Kerr, K-E-R-R, and then the words TED Talk.
Okay, thanks for that.
Okay.
You know what I forgot to ask you is that have you observed any of these shared visions, you know, where the people at the bedside actually have the same vision that their dying loved one has?
I have seen that. We had at least one experience where we had a child who was referencing seeing things that the patient was seeing.
Mm. You know, I often thought It just made me think of it now while you're talking about it. You know, one of the things that we do in the foundation, we have we evaluate, you know, mediumship evidence, and there are certain mediums that participate in research. And I always wondered if a research project could be started with having research mediums in a hospice setting, sitting, you know, with patients and wondering if they could tap into the same discarnate entities that are appearing to the patient. Ever think about that?
Yeah, well, I just did think about it because we had a film crew up that was involved in filming one of the paranormal activities shows and whatnot, but they're really into end-of-life dreams and visions. She made a good point. She said, you know, if there was ever a magical moment where such things were to occur, it would probably be at this point when life was leaving, at least towards the end of life as we know it on Earth. And she thought that would be an interesting point at which to study. I think you're spot on. I mean,
especially if the medium could provide specific evidence, you know, that could be validated.
I haven't thought of how to do this study, but it would be. I've heard of an interesting thing when they somebody was thought about for doing near-death experiences, which is they painted a symbol on a ceiling. Have you heard of this in the emergency room?
Yeah, that's the AWARE study. One of the unanticipated results there was that what they really didn't think of is that, just imagine yourself, so you're having this near-death experience and you're floating above your body in this hospital room, and you're totally amazed that of what's going on. You may not necessarily notice, you know, that the sign or the symbol that's up there. You're just so involved in everything else. So that's one possible explanation. On a personal level, working in hospice for so many years, it's obviously much sadness that you encounter, you know, every day. Does the inspiration make up for it? Is it draining on
you? Yeah. No. And it's one of the great myths of hospice is you would think that the people who do the work must be depressed or depressing. But we see the most, we're privileged to see some of the most profound acts of kindness and empathy and support and love. That it's quite the opposite. And, particularly when it comes to these sort of experiences, they may be physically dying, but emotionally and spiritually, they're very alive. And what they're experiencing, you know, isn't necessarily tragic at all. You see an 88-year-old man who is with his mother, who he hasn't seen since he was 5 years old. It's not necessarily depressing at all.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what advice would you give to somebody, who's a patient in hospice, who's having these experiences and trying to integrate that, you know, and find some meaning? I mean, what do you say when you talk to them about it?
What I do is I go there first, and I tell them that we're usually very concerned with sleep. Sleep disruption is probably our leading cause of confusion. So asking about sleep, and then asking about, are you having vivid dreams because it's common? And giving them, essentially what we try to do in our dialogue is give them permission or at least space to acknowledge it. And then the next question, do you want to talk about it? And it's amazing to see the actual relief physically, because there's everyone's different. There's a subset of people who don't know what to how to interpret it and keep it to themselves, and yet are absolutely overwhelmed with it. So they, it's healthy, and then encouraging them to share is important. Mm. Certainly want to get it out.
Yeah, I could imagine that it must be difficult for a lot of people. You know, they may have certain religious beliefs. They may worry that something's not right, you know, by having these things that they were taught couldn't happen. And just by the very fact of you telling them that that it's okay and that this is acceptable and this is the way it is, that in and of itself could be very comforting.
Yeah, it's interesting. So many people, though, are just absolutely, you know, so overwhelmingly comforted, they're telling you. You know,
right.
I had a guy recently, he said, you know, I went to every concert I've ever been to. You know, I'm doing garage sales. A lot of times you'll hear people, believe it or not, saying, I want to go back to what I was doing. And they're upset they're awake. And every so often we have somebody who says, you know, I was expecting these and I'm not having them.
Mm.
And they're distressed by that.
Right.
And some people seem to intuitively know that it's not their time because they haven't seen the spouse that they had died before them, you know. Yeah.
What can the rest of us learn from your research and from learning about these end-of-life experiences? What's the takeaway for the rest of us?
I think that, you know, that there is something illuminated in dying, and that, you know, although it's there's certainly the sense of finality and loss, that there's also a lot of wonder, and that a couple of things seem to happen is the overriding themes are certainly those of love. You know, it's interesting, our study, religious-based themes are nearly absent. I mean, the truth is people dream of their pets more than they dream of religious entities or symbols of formal religion, yet the tenets of faith are predominant. I mean, love and forgiveness. That it's that time seems to go away, so that we're connected between across lives, who those we've loved, and you know the lost sibling from, you know, 40 years ago is as vivid and as real in these experiences as they were 40 years ago. And there's something wonderful and actually life affirming about dying when it's viewed in that perspective, so that it's not all about loss. It's often about recollecting.
Yeah, I think that you, near the end of your TED talk, you spoke about a soldier, you know, who during the war was helping rescue, you know, other soldiers, and then he had an end-of-life experience, and in fact, all of these dead soldiers that he tried to save in the war were coming to greet him.
Yeah, I mean, it's a phenomenal story. He was a 17-year-old kid when he was involved in Normandy. And the boat he was on actually was not like one of those drop crafts. It was sent to shore to rescue a stranded group of soldiers. And he only talked about the return trip and body parts and dying that he was pulling into the boat. And he never spoke of it during his life, and his family was absolutely amazed he was talking about it, but he couldn't evade it. You know, he was flooded with all this imagery. And then, you know, he had two types of dreams. One were comforting, the day that he got to relive when he got his discharge papers. And the other, when a soldier says, you know, we're coming to get you now. So, yeah, he was rescued by those he tried to rescue.
Yeah.
And that's what I meant by the dreams, the predominant theme tends to address whatever need we seem to, or burden or lesion we have from having lived. So this guy was injured and harmed in a way that he could, you know, he lived for 67 years with his pain. And in the end, he was unburdened.
Powerful. We have been talking with Dr. Christopher Kerr. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. I hope you'll come back and join us, you know, some other time.
I'll be happy to.
For those, again, just... Google Christopher Kerr in Hospice Buffalo, and then the link that Dr. Kerr mentioned, and you'll see a wealth of information that's inspiring. Thank you, and we hope to see you again.
Yeah, my privilege. Thank you.
All right, take care.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy for more participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind as we visualize the healing light upon Karen Gould, Stanley Mullen, Glenna Irwin, Michael Kim, David Hayes, Marianne Pierzga, Donna Mello, Matt Mello, Fred Feinstein, James Rafferty, Doreen Malloy, Diane Archangel, and Joan Lipke. Now let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.